Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday morning. It's the 20th of July, about 10 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we're a little early this morning because we are expecting that Governor Andrew Cuomo will be giving a briefing and a press conference at 9:30 this morning from JFK Airport, and we will be going to that live as soon as it becomes available shortly after 9:30 this morning. So we're trying to get as much panel in as possible, and then when the governor concludes, we'll come back and finish up our conversation with our group this morning. And what a group it is. Let me introduce everybody so we can get right to it. First, a reminder, if you'd like to join in on the conversation, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm good. I walked in the rain this morning. It was great. And then when I got home, it really opened up. So we're very grateful for the ACE weather report, which said occasional showers possible.
There you go. I think that was the working title. It was walking in the rain. And then they said, well, maybe singing in the rain would be better.
Oh, yeah. Maybe that would be good.
So give him something else to do. Well, good morning, Alan. We also welcome Jennifer Burns to the program, U Albany lecturer in Africana Studies. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning, everyone.
Very nice to have you on the program. Libby Post is with us as well, political consultant to the stars. Hello, Libby. How are you feeling?
Good morning, Joe. I'm doing just fine. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. At Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Glad
well,
to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. Again, thank you all for doing this, and thank you all for, as I said, we're going to go till 9:30. We'll hear from the governor, and then we'll come back, and we'll finish up then. So we'll have a little bit of a donut this morning. The governor's remarks will be the whole of the donut, I think, right? Yeah, that's how that works. Okay, here we go. A lot going on, and mostly having to do with the coronavirus and the president's remarks over the weekend in interviews that were, strange, disturbing, and largely untrue, according to most media outlets. But here we go. As Trump ignores the virus crisis, Republicans start to break ranks. President Trump continues to press for a quick return to life as usual, but Republicans who fear a rampaging disease and angry voters are increasingly going their own way. The president's failure to contain the coronavirus outbreak and his refusal to promote clear public health guidelines have left many senior Republicans despairing that he will ever play a constructive role in addressing the crisis, with some concluding they must work around Mr. Trump and ignore or even contradict his pronouncements. In recent days, some of the most prominent figures in the GOP outside the White House have broken with Mr. Trump over issues like the value of wearing a mask in public and heeding the advice of health experts like Dr. Anthony S. Fauci, whom the president and other hard right figures within the administration have subjected to caustic personal criticism. They appear to be spurred by several overlapping forces, including deteriorating conditions in their own states, Mr. Trump's seeming indifference to the problem, and the approach of a presidential election in which Mr. Trump is badly lagging his Democratic challenger, Joe Biden, in the polls. Alan, let's go. What do you think?
First of all, Joe, a lot of money coming Trump's way. He's collecting a ton of money right now. I can only guess that his supporters understand it's now or never that they could really lose. Up until now, Biden's been beating Trump, but not now, and it's of some concern to the people who want to see Trump out of there. That's one thing. The second thing is that the conferences in the legislature, in the state legislature, in the Congress, are anything but equal. The boss is the boss, and McConnell is the boss. If he switches, and he has been switching, he's been backing Fauci, he's been doing all the other stuff, you better believe that he's not speaking for himself. He's getting a lot of heat from his own people. Now, some of them, Lindsey Graham and some of the others, have actually spoken out. Nevertheless, it is a sign when the leader says, we don't like this, or I don't like this, that he means we don't like this. And by the way, he's in a very difficult race in his own state. He could lose.
Mitch McConnell, yeah. Libby, what do you think about Republicans now being a little concerned and gun-shy?
Well, I think they should be concerned. They could very well lose control of the U.S. Senate. Mark Kelly is polling far and ahead of McSally in Arizona. Susan Collins is in trouble. Sarah Gideon in Maine. There are a number of other seats. I mean, even Lindsey Graham, that one looks neck and neck right now. Jamie Harrison, a man of color, who's running against Lindsey Graham. I mean, there's a number of seats that are open, and we could take it all. And so, yeah, I think that McConnell is going to do what is good for McConnell so that he can maintain his majority in the Senate. And if it means breaking with the president, I think that that's what you're going to see, and you're going to see a lot of it. And if it means Biden taking the White House but the Republicans keeping control of the Senate, then that's what he'll do.
I just want to make a comment, if I may, Joe, very quickly, and that is when we hear from Libby, that we means Libby. That doesn't mean that the station has a political affiliation with either party. Okay?
Right, but everyone knows that I'm a Democratic political consultant. I don't think my
that's fine.
Is in question at all.
No, yeah. Not at all. You are absolutely entitled to be whatever you want. I just wanted to make sure everybody understood that when you said we, it meant
absolutely.
You and your circle. Yeah,
Jennifer Burns.
Right. You know, I agree with what Libby's saying, and I also, you know, really. I think it's going to be interesting in what Mitch McConnell offers, right, as he's penning this relief bill that's coming up. I think he is trying to figure out a way to make that attractive to more Republicans and people within his state to get reelected, and at the same time maybe shift away from Trump a little bit mm-hmm. without actually saying so. That's what I think is kind of happening.
And when you see that the president is getting together with those people today, that means he sees problems. You're exactly right on the horizon, and he wants to make sure everybody's in line.
Well, all you need to do is watch the Chris
Wallace
interview, and it's so clear he's losing even Fox News. I mean, Chris Wallace is starting to channel his dad, which is nice to see.
Chris Wallace has been pretty good all along.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not exactly switching today. You know, the guy's got guts.
But the interview made news because, as I was said at the beginning, there were a lot of mistruths. And he claimed that the United States had the lowest death rate in the world, that new cases were surging here mostly because of the large number of tests, and that his virus response had saved, quote, millions of lives. The virus has still been deadlier in several European countries than in the U.S. after adjusting for population, but the total death rate in the U.S. is among the worst for any country in the world. And the U.S. may continue to climb this ranking. Most high-income countries now have a relatively small number of cases and deaths each day, while the U.S. does not. Also, the U.S. is conducting a large number of tests, but that isn't why the virus statistics look so much worse here. That, according to Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. has now conducted more tests per capita than any other country. That high test rate obviously leads to a greater number of official cases. If some other countries with major outbreaks like Brazil, Mexico, and Nigeria were conducting more tests, they would likely be reporting many more cases. But in the U.S. is still an outlier, especially among rich countries. A higher percentage of its tests are coming back positive than in many other countries. Sarah Rogerson.
So I'm thinking about this weekend, and I was recalling that coronavirus in America has hit Black and brown communities much harder. And it reminded me of our still raging opioid crisis, right?
Yes.
That once white people started to die from overdoses in alarming numbers, all of a sudden the politics around the opioid crisis shifted, right? And I was wondering to myself if that's what it's going to take, if coronavirus hitting Trump's base, because right at the moment they feel immune to the whole thing, whether that will help from a public messaging perspective, whether that will be the tipping point, or whether, you know, we need to start gathering data. And it's awful that is actually how this administration responds with good policy. But I was wondering to myself that something like that tipping point would almost have to be the thing that happens in order for us to get any sort of reasonable response from this White House, because all that the president's going to do is bully these Republicans back into line. He's doing it with every other state.
Yeah, no, you bet. That's exactly right. You know, Sarah, I was thinking about you because, you know, for weeks we talked with you as our star, and you are, about the amount of damage that was being done to this country in terms of Trump's immigration stance. And you, of course, spoke about that at length to us. It seems as if it's off the scoreboard for some reason. Do you think about that?
Every day. It's certainly not off the scoreboard in terms of him winning points.
No.
We're expecting an announcement this week. Not sure what the announcement is going to be. There's a lot of speculation around what it might be. Could be something related to DACA. Could be a more wider sweeping executive order. You know, immigration practitioners and immigrant communities have been bracing for impact since the inauguration, and so we'll just wait and see, and sue, and fight. There was a victory last week with regard to, international student visas. So we're gonna keep fighting at every turn, but families are still being separated. It's happening now. There's a great video out by Raisis about some of the more recent rulings of Judge G in California with respect to family detention. And right now, the government has given families a week who are detained to decide whether or not they're gonna stay with their kids in detention or let the government separate them from their children while they stay in these detention facilities. It's just awful. We just don't have enough space on the front of the paper, or I guess enough of an attention span as a country to handle all of the horrific things that are happening right now.
Well, you know, as a legal analyst, I was interested in what you made of the attack on the judge who is a woman. And the shooting, killing of her son, and the wounding of her husband. Do you have any sense, premonition, or anything that's what's going on here? This is something new that comes along with a president who says, "I may not leave the White House even if I lose the election."
Yeah, and it's deeply, deeply troubling. It's not even. I mean, the attack on the judge and her son, but also. What's happening in Portland, Oregon, with federal DHS, essentially, you know, trained thugs who are going after peaceful protesters in Portland. I was watching that coverage all weekend and was just beside myself about it. It's unacceptable, and we're definitely creeping towards something terrible in this country. We're all going to have to get out the vote. We're all going to have to march people to the polls. This is it for America.
You know, I've been watching the Hitler Channel.
There's a Hitler Channel?
Yeah, there's a Hitler Channel. We call it the Hitler Channel. It's I think 140 on the spectrum thing, and it's all about World War II, Hitler. They keep recounting the rise of Hitler. And boy, if you watch that, you feel pretty uncomfortable, as you say, Sarah, about what's going on in Portland, Oregon, because you could be watching the Hitler Channel.
Jennifer Burns, any thoughts?
Well, and I think there's a combination here. We're seeing it in multiple systems within our government, right? I mean, I relate this situation in Portland when it comes to sending in these federal troops, you know, sweeping people off the streets in unmarked cars, And things like that, with the other kind of dog whistle politics that's going on. And, you know, when it comes to racial resentment in this country, this is part of the key. It also ties into immigration, right? It's the brown people. It goes back to that kind of idea, these agitators, as Trump continues to say, right? And so we're seeing the government use, you know, dog whistle politics to continue to target black and brown people, some that are citizens, some that are immigrants, in these ways where his base and other people, I will say, who are not in his base don't recognize that the race card, he's using race. And when it attaches to healthcare too, when it's going on with coronavirus, like Sarah said, when it starts to hit those really large white and in some cases, it's sad to say, suburban communities, right, which is why the government and Trump is trying to keep that so quiet. Right, with this different way of reporting, right? The CDC doesn't get the information anymore.
Right.
He wants to keep that quiet so that people will not vote against him in those places where he has really been able to pull the votes. And now we're seeing that more people that are not all white people, but many who are not of that strong right, you know, base, are starting to really pay attention a little bit more. And so if he keeps things quiet still when it comes to the racial problems and the attack on black and brown people, and he also continues to then kind of shine a light where they're the bad ones, or, you know, that's the problem over there, he's trying to build more votes back for himself. This is a systematic way of trying to control the sound, the words, but then also suppress the people who are rising against this horrific homophobia, sexism, racism in America.
Something you touched on, Jennifer, in your the beginning of your remarks is circling back to what we were talking about at the beginning, which is the Senate now working on a coronavirus relief package. And as you indicated, this is going to tell us a lot about what you were just talking about. So what do you think this is a marathon. This is going to be 3 weeks before the August break as Senate is back and they return today. So what do you think we can expect in these negotiations?
Honestly, I have no idea. I really am, you know, almost every hour the rhetoric changes. And you really have to work very hard to stay on the point, because otherwise what's happening is there's these distractions with other things, even like the idea that Trump is now going to have a human rights commission. Right? People, which should not be taking place, led by him and others. It just should not. You know, so I don't really know what to expect. I expect a lot of backbiting. I expect a lot of fighting. I expect a lot of hidden racism. I expect a lot of classism to unfold here. And the issue that's really concerning me, too, is the liability part. Right? It's a way of blocking people out if they are harmed by what's going on, and especially the majority of people who are of color and who are the working poor.
Alan?
So I don't know.
Well, you know, I'm very interested in what's going to happen in terms of the negotiation between, you know, Nancy Pelosi, the House of Representatives, the $3 million Heroes Act, and the $1 million which being dragged to the table, McConnell is now talking about. Obviously, there'll have to be some kind of reconciliation there. The Republicans are scared to death who are up for the Senate. You know, the Republicans who are in close races are scared to death. This is going to hurt them very badly. Because people want that $600 to continue. They are dependent upon it. And not only that, but you got all the governors and everybody else, including Republican governors, who are saying, we cannot do our jobs if you don't save us. New York has a $16 billion deficit, which has to be filled. And the governor here has been insistent that that happened and that we do not make plans, although I'm sure they're making them, you know, surreptitiously. We don't make plans to closing down our schools and 20% firing of teachers and all the rest of it. So I think that there will be some kind of reconciliation. My bet is, if I had to put a number on it, $2 billion.
Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah, it's a mess to be sure. Whatever comes out is not going to be predictable and or transparent, and or quite frankly, good government. So I, you know, the pressure's building on states. Lots of states are struggling. That will continue.
I have to interrupt.
Yeah, the governor's on.
To bring you the governor, Andrew Cuomo. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We took a little break to hear from the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, who was speaking from JFK Airport before flying to Savannah, Georgia. We can talk a little bit about that. Let me reintroduce everybody, remind you that we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we will get to some letters in just a few moments. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. Hello again.
Still here. Listen to the governor. Very interesting.
Yes. Anything that caught you that you'd like to talk about?
Well, you know, I've spent some time in Savannah. It's a wonderful town. Of course, they took the bench away, but I'm not going to blame them for that. You may remember.
That would be the Forrest Gump bench.
Forrest Gump sitting on the bench. They put it in their museum. But other than that, it's a beautiful little town. I think he'll be well treated there when he gets there.
UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. Glad to be back.
Wonderful to have you back, Libby Post. Thanks for holding on.
Hey, no problem.
And Sarah Rogerson, Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic. Good morning, Sarah.
Hi.
So we were talking about the coronavirus before, talking about COVID, and as we were going into the governor's remarks, and of course the governor speaking a lot about compliance and people behaving themselves. I don't know. Do you think? What do you think you can do, and Libby, I'll start with you, of what do you do to get people to finally hear the message? Obviously, the governor talking about the big issue being bars and restaurants.
Well, I mean, I think that he has done a great job of messaging in terms of constantly repeating. It takes at least seven times for something to sink in, and one would think it would be, when it's a matter of life and death, it would be a little less than that. But he's constantly, not harping, but repeating the messaging. I think what needs to happen is that there needs to be peer-to-peer messaging for youth. I think, you know, they started a while back, they did a thing with John Leguizamo and Rosie Perez to reach out to the Latino community. I think they need to bring in some, you know, 20-something, some the social media influencers, you know, all those kinds of young folks to start talking about this and talking about how important it is to wear masks and to put pictures on Instagram, and that might have an impact with the younger cohort. And the other thing is that they just need to take the liquor license away from the bars that don't pay attention to the law. It's just that simple. Shut them down. You know, I mean, it's just absurd. They are a breeding ground for disease, and they shouldn't be allowed to operate.
You know, you're right about everything you've said, Libby, except that, you know, there are some people who will not be deterred. I don't know whether it's suicidal.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it's suicidal, but it's amazing how many people are on those beaches. How many people are going into the bars when they can, despite you said at least seven times. He could say it 700 times, and they would still do it.
There's no accounting for stupid. I mean, there just isn't. So, you know, it's just, it is what it is. And we've got, you know, to get as many people to be as compliant as possible. I get it. I mean, I would love to go sit at a restaurant and be served and have a nice dinner, you know, but we're not doing that. Not very often. You know, we went to our local pub because after my first PT, last week, because it was, we could sit outside and everybody had a mask and it felt relatively safe, but we do it rarely. And people just need to be compliant and get with the program, but there's no accounting for stupid. You know, if people don't want to listen, they're not going to listen. Once they get sick, once their friends get sick, then they'll start to listen.
There is, we got an interesting letter, and I was just reading it, so of course, oh, there it is. Governor Cuomo said multiple times during his press conference that the COVID-related safety mandates need to be vigorously enforced. He also called out the police more than once for allegedly not enforcing these measures. Given the current national conversation about the role of law enforcement in American life, do you feel that the governor's assertions and criticism of the police lack of COVID mandate enforcement are fair and realistic? How aggressive and proactive should the police be, especially when they know they will likely face intense scrutiny and criticism should one of these enforcement encounters escalate and require a use of force? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Chuck.
Yeah, you're right. That is a difficult one for police people, which is why a lot of police people are resigning from the force, because they know that if they're too outspoken or too actionable, that you know, things will go against them. Nevertheless, this governor and the mayor of New York don't get along very, as I might say, very good. They don't get along good, and as a result of that, he rarely misses a time to let de Blasio have it. He has to be both progressive, but he also knows that people care about their personal safety. And that's what this is. That's what that whistle was all about.
Jennifer.
Part of me always struggles with this because, you know, I worry that local police will end up being pushed into sort of the outcomes will be similar to a stop and frisk type situation, because we know the coronavirus is happening more and more in Black and brown communities, right? So how will the funding go for this? Will the police be pushed or encouraged to be more rigorous in those areas? Will they increase police in other areas where they're not, the demographic is different, you know, to also try to enforce this?
Right.
But I also then see it as a little bit of an opportunity. You know, I was in a local Stewart's by my house the other day, and I had a mask on, and a man came. It was clear that he was rushing very quickly, you know, and he came in without a mask. And the worker came around very politely, and she had a mask, and she just said, you know, I'm sorry, sir, I won't be able to serve you unless you wear this. And he just said, oh, okay. You know, and he put it on, he came up. And in talking about the police, you know, is there any allocation for them to have masks, to carry them? You know, and how will that happen if they say, look, this is the order, here is one? I mean, could that be used as a community building initiative in a positive way? You know, I don't know, because some people are really still opposed to that encounter with the police.
Right.
And again, it depends on where you are. So it's a tough one.
Sarah?
Yeah, I think until we get this policing situation under control, and it's community by community, we really need to reserve police community interactions for things that the police are well equipped to handle, not for public health emergencies. They've become the front lines on a lot of public health emergencies. We have police officers trained on Narcan, for example. People's lives have been saved by police officers. I agree that that as much as possible, officers should be, because they are in contact with the community, distributing masks. We see that happening locally. But the problem that we have, even in New York, in New York State, the New York State Sheriff's Association just announced a laundry list of absurd, in my opinion, legislative proposals that make things like approaching a police officer a felony. So like, it doesn't matter if the officer is holding a mask and trying to help you. You know, what does it mean? Can you approach them without committing a crime?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything is upside down with policing in America, even in New York. And until we have some of that resolved, and some of the demands met by people of color, by Black Lives Matter movements, you know, we aren't anywhere near talking about police intervening in healthcare crises. So it would be more damage than it's worth. I agree with Libby. You go after the source of the problem. If you shut off the tap, the beer stops flowing and people got to go someplace else.
Hmm. I want to get back to the, you know, what we started talking about this morning before we went over to the governor is the administration's response to the coronavirus. The president, as we mentioned earlier, was a guest on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace. He said in the interview that the rising number of U.S. deaths from coronavirus, quote, is what it is. Defended his fumbled management of the pandemic with a barrage of dubious and false claims and revealed his lack of understanding about the fundamental science of how the virus spreads and infects people. Making one of the biggest media appearances in months, an hour-long sit-down interview with Chris Wallace, Trump was visibly rattled and at times hostile as he struggled to answer for his administration's failure to contain the coronavirus, which he claimed, which has claimed more than 137,000 lives in the United States. And I'm reading from the Washington Post. On a range of other topics, including the racial justice movement and the Confederate flag, the president positioned himself firmly outside the political mainstream, and Trump suggested he might not accept the results of November's general election should he lose, because he predicted without evidence that mail-in voting is going to rig the election. So, Alan, here we go, right?
Well, I mean, it is so clear that he is just humping and fumping and carrying along. And he is playing to a base which is decreasing. He's in real trouble with his fellow Republicans who are really fearful that they will lose their offices as a result of his malfeasance and whatever other words you want to use. He doesn't have a way out. Now, when you look at his niece and what she has written, it all fits. This is a guy who doesn't think there is another way besides his narcissistic, self image. I'm right about everything, and that's all there is to it. And the problem is that he's gotten away with this for his entire life. He's been put down. His casinos have gone into bankruptcy. His university has been closed. And yet he's still here. He's the president of the United States, and you're never going to convince him. So when you listen to him and you listen to the kind of, endless stream of consciousness that he's capable of, you get the idea there's only one way out. And now he's saying, I may not leave. Mm. And boy, that's really something.
Libby?
Well, the whole idea of, I'll have to see if I agree with the results of the election. I mean, there are, the staff in the White House on the inauguration day, regardless of whether he agrees with it or not, are going to pack up all of his belongings and they're going to be shipped right out. And, I think if he tries to do anything like stay and say, no, the results aren't true, I think given the fact that, it might go end up at the Supreme Court, but I don't think they'll do anything if it's overwhelming. It's not going to be like hanging chads in Florida. But I think you'll see the military escorting him out of the White House. I do think that you'll see people standing up and saying, no, you have to leave. You lost. I mean, we have to remember he won by a very slim margin. Hillary won the popular vote by 3 million votes, but I think he is like a trapped animal in a corner now.
We
all know what that's like. We all know what that's like. And he will do anything. He will bite. He will scratch. He'll spit. He'll do whatever he needs to get out of that corner. And, hopefully there'll be some really good animal control people around.
By the way, Libby, I'm not so sure you're right. With all due respect and great love, I'm not sure you're right. This is a guy who, if he thinks he can get away with it, now we posit that the American people will rise up as one and throw him out, or that people will come and escort him out. But this is how dictatorships happen. This is how fascism, totalitarianism happens. I hope you're right. I would think that, he'll have to go. But if he is as bad as some of us think he is, he'll do anything in his power to stay there. And if that means changing our Democratic Republican system of government, he will do that.
We'll have to wait and see.
Yes, we will.
Yeah.
Jennifer, what do you make of that?
You know, I have a lot of questions, I guess. You know, I think about others around him. So, like, you know, the Attorney General Bill Barr. What is he thinking or trying to do now leading up to the election in case that happens? Is there anything he can do to stall things? You know, that's one of my questions. How could he use, you know, the Department of Justice or something to try to keep Trump in there? And then the other thing is, you know, Trump is also a king of lawsuits. So I'm not, you know, a legal professional, but is there any way he could sue different branches of government or the people or something over what he claims is voter fraud and other things like that?
He'd have to sue every single state in the nation that didn't vote his way. He'd have to sue every board of elections. I mean, it would be quite the legal effort.
And Sarah,
I'm not a legal person. I'm not a lawyer either. Sarah could actually.
Yeah, let's go to the legal person.
I'm not an election lawyer, although I have dabbled from time to time. I think Libby's right. It would be really kind of an incredible undertaking. And it seems like it's more in this president's style, because we gave him the White House, because we gave him the executive powers to use the leverages of the executive branch. I think he's more likely to try to, you know, run things through his pals over at the Department of Justice, try to allege voter fraud, ask for multiple recounts, whatever the federal laws allow, he'll take advantage of the laws and then take it a step further and empower the Justice Department and others. It's typically the Justice Department lawyers who are doing election monitoring to see if there's a way to either, you know, he breeds insecurity in this country by insinuating to his base that they can't rely on the staples of good governance, right? So he's more likely to incite a riot than actually participate in, I think, any sort of good faith litigation around the election. This is all building up for him to have his own militia, his own little army all across the United States. And it's already happening.
Now, all of us know that there is a segment of the population that's listening to us now and saying, oh my God, listen to them go off in hysteria. And conspiracy theory upon conspiracy theory. But we have a track record here, don't we, Alan? I mean, we have even the president himself. I mean, I just want a reality check that it is quite unheard of in a nationally televised interview with a president of the United States that the president says he may not accept the results of an election.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying. And it is in keeping and typical with this person and his sense of self, which is not good. Do I think that he's capable of it if he thinks he can get away with it? I absolutely do. Now, I agree with the other panelists. I think it's be very difficult to do. Nevertheless, I don't know. You know, in other countries, when something goes wrong, people come out with pots and pans and sticks and by the millions. We don't see that in this country. We may see it in the Mother's March and a couple of other things, which was almost a street fair because I was there, and I know it. But in terms of day after day after day and saying, absolutely, you shall not pass, I don't see that happening if he does what I suspect he would like to do. I hope I'm wrong.
Libby?
I think you will see people. I think you'll see people going to the streets. I think you'll see the women's marches, men's marches. I think there's a blue wave. There was one in 2018, 2019. It's coming in 2020. And I think people will take to the streets if he tries anything like this.
Well, I think one could assume you're right.
There'll be pandemonium. Yeah.
One could assume you're right. Okay. And will they have guns? And will they charge the White House? And will they say, out of there, you know, out of there, Trump? Will they do that, Libby? Is that the way that
no,
this country
is? No, they'll be on the streets. Yeah,
on the streets, on the streets, as we know, doesn't count. What counts is getting them out of...
Alan, on the streets, stop the Vietnam War. On the streets, started the civil rights movement. It started the gay rights movement. On the streets, has its role, does do things. And in this particular case, it'll be on the streets, and there may very well be rioting. There very may, they very well may be lives lost over there.
He would love it.
But on the
he
streets,
would love,
yes, he would.
He
yes,
would love rioting because it's...
Have work.
He would love it and say, I have to move in with the troops, and I have to put a stop to this, as we saw him do the other day. Listen, I don't want to be arguing against myself. I hope you're right. And I hope, you know what I'm saying? I hope you're right.
Yeah.
I hope it will go that way. And you're right that on the streets did stop Vietnam and all the rest. But we had courts. We had other things. We had a Supreme Court which said unanimously that Nixon had to give up the tapes. I don't know that we have that now. We just saw a terrible series of Supreme Court decisions, which really said, oh, no man is above the law. But on the other hand, go back and discuss it further until after the election. That's disgusting. Disgusting. 7-2.
Let's go to a couple of letters on the subject. Ted says, why do reporters asking why are... Well, see, this is why it's important to pre-read and
absolutely
make sure that it has that you have, you know, verbs in your sentences. This is about Trump not leading office. Ted says, so I missed the first line of it, but why are people even thinking that this is an option? It is not for Trump to respond. We will have we have elected a president.
Well, you elected a president with a minority vote last time, and that was when he wasn't president. Now he's president. He has the entire bureaucracy at his disposal. That's why. And also, we know something about his character. So do we think he is capable of doing this? Absolutely.
A prediction. Gina says Trump loses big, resigns, Pence pardons him, New York gets him.
Anything's possible.
Tom says, when I heard of Trump's strong-arm tactics in Portland, the first thing that came to mind was Pinochet and his Chilean secret police in the 70s and 80s. Trump would have idolized Pinochet, and now it seems that he has his own secret police.
Does indeed.
You know what was great about that, the uprising against Pinochet, too? I actually studied a segment of this, is that it was women who got together to do like knitting circles and discuss their traditional roles in society. It was under that guise that they were actually organizing to restore democracy. And I just thought that that was so subversive and an amazing story. You know, we aren't at the point where we're so censored that we can't gather together. Obviously, the governor's rightly upset about how much people are gathering together, you know, to talk about our rights. But it's in studying the overthrow of those dictatorships where we all need to get more fluent. You know, we're getting fluent on anti-racism, and we all need to, you know, start building up those summer reading lists to figure out how to respond if he does what he's saying he'll do.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll have our last go-round with the panel this morning. Joining us, Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. We include your letters as well, and we welcome yours. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll get to more letters in just a few moments. And again, we will continue our conversation on this and many other topics right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Got a few letters. And Linda says, I totally agree with Alan about the documentaries about Hitler and his rise. I watched them about a week ago. The similarities are frightening. Travis says, say the federal government said, okay, everyone wears a mask in public. How might that actually be enforced? Well, that goes back to what we were talking about before in the police, right?
Everybody has to...
Yeah, we should self-enforce. I mean, a federal mandate goes a long way to create the normative change where people are shamed into wearing masks. It sets a benchmark.
Everybody has to pay their income tax, right?
Right. And another listener says, I know the police's job is tough, but it's still their job. The fact that it is harder due to their own systematic failures on race is hardly everyone else's fault. When our jobs are hard, we don't get to slack off. Why should they?
It's not a question of why should they, but that they're doing it. In other words, I'm not saying that they should slack off. I'm saying there's some evidence that a lot of policemen are retiring right now. We know that there are certain types of people, not all, but certain types of people who get attracted to police forces. And once that power, that ultimate power, is taken away from them, they resign. And by the way, in small towns like mine in Great Barrington, people don't like to discipline the police. Too fearful of that. And we've seen several examples of that in town votes, a town meeting, that kind of thing. It's not as easy as people think.
I want to get to a couple of topics before we end this morning. One, of course, is the weekend started off sadly with the loss of John Lewis, a towering figure of the civil rights era. And he passed away due to cancer on Friday. And a Democrat, of course, and he announced late last year, I think it was right before the new year, that he had stage 4 pancreatic cancer and vowed to fight it. And was seen just a few weeks ago with the Black Lives Matter mural that was in Washington by the Capitol. I just thought I'd go around and talk to you about this man and what he accomplished, and your thoughts on his loss. Alan.
Well, first of all, Joe, I just want to point out that unless things have changed, that you're going to play your interview, your excellent interview with John Lewis today. Is that right?
That's correct.
That's great.
It's 11:30.
Okay, that's terrific. And second of all, we had the privilege of being with him and eating with him. He's quite a guy. He's exactly what you want. He's a believer in nonviolence, but he really knew how to do what he had to do, and a very courageous fellow.
Jennifer.
You know, I'm always struck by how little often people pay attention to someone when they're alive, because John Lewis really began as a youth, right, in the movement for civil rights in America. And kept that struggle up, being progressive, changing tactics, really studying strategies, grassroots organizing across the nation with so many people. You know, he worked with, presidential candidates. Even going back to like Bobby Kennedy, focused on poor people's campaigns and really trying to unite people across racial lines. As we're talking about him, he's sort of overshadowing C.T. Vivian, who also did very much that same work, and he started doing it before what we consider the modern civil rights movement began with the Brown decision and then picked up in the 60s. C.T. Vivian was doing this in the late 40s in Chicago, right? And so, we look at these decades that it has taken for civil rights to continue to be focused on, and we're looking at it again now after Lewis has died, in that one of the last things he was really focusing on and fighting for was the Voting Rights Advancement Act, right, to remedy what was stripped out of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 by the Shelby County versus Holder decision in 2013, creating the voter suppression we're seeing today. And so I think the greatest honor of this man and lesson for many of us is to pay attention to the long history of people working in civil rights, you know, for everyone in America, not just the black people or the brown people, but everyone in America, and to get involved to make sure, in particular right now, that Voting Rights Advancement Act is signed by Mitch McConnell. Let's get going here.
Libby.
I don't know what to say anymore. I mean, I agree. I don't know. John Lewis's moniker, Good Trouble, is what I want to live for for the rest of my life. You know, I think we all need to get into some good trouble and to make good trouble. He was, you know, more than just an icon. He was an example set for all of us. And it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking that we keep, you know, losing these folks. Reverend Vivian is another person that we've lost, as Jennifer said. And, you know, but it's now up to us to keep their legacies alive and to keep pushing and to not let up until we get what we need, which is full rights for everybody. Black Lives Matters. You know, we no longer, I mean, on Facebook, I saw this sign at a church down south that says black people stay out of white people's churches. I mean, you know, what kind of crap is this? You know, we've got to get beyond the hate in order for our country to get back to any kind of normalcy.
Sarah.
That's all.
Yeah, last night my husband and I made the decision to sit down with our children and watch Good Trouble. And I commend everyone here to watch it immediately at your first opportunity. And, you know, it's rated for 18 and over, but we felt it was important for our kids who are 10 and 7 to see and to appreciate and to understand and to tie together the struggle of that time up till now, right? This is the perfect opportunity. I can think of no better way to honor that man's memory than to make sure that we are educating ourselves and the generations to come after us, and to trace that, the moral arc, right, and make sure that it bends toward justice. So we were all riveted, even my 7-year-old, for an hour and a half, which is very hard to do. And they asked tough questions. They asked important questions, and now they understand a little bit better our family values and why we commit our time to certain things. And so I think it's incumbent upon everyone to honor the legacy of a pillar of democracy and civil disobedience in our country.
Well, you know, I'd love to go back just for a second, Joe, to the concept of Mitch McConnell better sign the bill, the voting rights bill. What in the world would make you think that this guy, who is a puppet of the president, and who knows that if black and brown people go out and vote in the numbers that they represent, that Trump will certainly lose by even more. He won't do it, right? Am I wrong, Jennifer?
You know, I think this comes back to how we've made this also, you know, the political drive here of McConnell, because I agree with you that one of the reasons people don't want to do it is because they know it was going to have a tremendous, you know, impact on this next election. The other piece of this, though, is, again, we have to go back to what's going on with coronavirus, because that's real and happening now. And then also this relief bill that McConnell's working on. I think he's really looking to keep his position and trying to juggle all those balls in the air. And if he can find a way to sign this and still stay in good favor elsewhere, I think he will. If he can't, he won't. And then, of course, there's going to be, I hope people are paying attention, and there's a greater uproar about this and about voter suppression. You know, as we still see the Black Lives Matters protesting, I mean, that's what's going on still in Portland, you know? And I hope that other countries who have continued to have Black Lives Matters protests there will see this, and they will pay attention to it, and they will protest and support it. I mean, really what's happening is we're seeing countries around the globe look at America and call us out about how we act through our government in apartheid ways. That's what's happening. We are seeing that now.
Well, you know, I think you're right on the COVID relief bill. He has to do that. But I don't believe you're right when it even comes to sanctions from other places or our people, that he will purposely allow that president to get on him for losing the election. And that is what it represents when everybody who is either an ex-felon, pardon me, an ex-felon or anybody like that to vote, you see what they're going to do. They're going to put a stop to it.
We got go ahead.
You know what? And shame on him, but also shame on us. I think we all really need to take a better look at what's happening and really consider it when we're, you know, we're focused on so many things right now, and coronavirus is so real, and we're getting kind of caught up in the mask thing, which we need, and all these other issues. But, you know, just like John Lewis said, the greatest protection of freedom in America, the thing that shows people that this is a democracy and that protects individuals, is to be able to cast a ballot. We really need to keep that in mind.
You're so right.
We got this from Johnny, who writes, I had the opportunity to briefly meet John Lewis at Union College's 2013 commencement, where he was the speaker. We shook hands, and both of us being natives of Alabama and of a similar age, Mr. Lewis asked about my family and told me of his. But as we talked, he continued to hold my white hand in his for our entire conversation. I don't remember exactly what he said, but I'll never forget how his simple yet profound act of warmth and acceptance by holding my hand made me feel. We got letters on other subjects.
Wow.
Mary writes, Trump has been encouraging and supporting the military and the police all along. Maybe he thinks he can count on them to support him by violence if he loses the election. Bennett says, I agree with Alan. Based on a lack of public response to the Bush v. Gore decision, which threw the presidency to the loser, that Americans have not effectively taken to the streets during political crisis. But the various public protests happening around the country in recent months are an excellent mechanism for keeping people organized for mobilization. Should such a need arise to oust Trump in November. Diane says, regardless of where 45 sits and hangs on Inauguration Day, once Biden is sworn in, Biden is president. Biden doesn't have to be in the White House to govern. He could order the military to remove the imposter.
Look, we've had somebody in the White House not governing, so it's true.
All right. We are just about out of time. I want to thank everybody who took part this morning. Thank you, panelists, for being so patient for having a press conference in the middle of our conversation, but I appreciate you hanging on and coming back afterwards. Alan, thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Joe.
Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, Sarah Rogerson, thanks to all of you. We will return with the Congressional Corner right after this.